Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate that everything, simply everything you could possibly think of, has its own history, like acorns, irritability, and the yawn.
Ooh, I love the idea of doing the yawn. I think that would really test us. All we could do, snails, nails, and whales, scales, tails, and males. But actually, what I really want to do, because I've just come back from Lisbon, which is utterly fabulous. I want to do the history of tiles, Sam. I went to the National Tile Museum, which is not as boring as it might sound. It's utterly fascinating. You say that with a yawn in your voice.
No, I'd love to do the history of the tile. I think that's fantastic. I could talk to you all about my trip to Samarkand in Uzbekistan, which is the tile capital of the world.
Let's do that next week. What I don't know about tiles, having traipsed my children around this museum, is not worth knowing, Samuel Willis.
You know what? I was in Croatia the other week, and I was in Split, in the great Roman palace of Diocletian. So it's the most perfectly preserved Roman palace in the world, and they have a particularly splendid mosaic floor. And it also reminded me of I think some of my earliest sort of memories of being interested in history come from mosaics, because I was brought up in St Albans, and there's an amazing Roman museum based around Verulamium, and one of the kind of the things that smacks you around the face and says find out more about me is the mosaics there. Tiles, like it.
Tiles, it's very, very good. We should get sponsored by a tile company, I think, as well.
Tops,
it'd be very
tops
useful.
Tiles.
Tops tiles, yes. Hey, however, we are digressing monstrously, more monstrously than usual, because for the moment we'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining very carefully indeed how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam Willis, who knew that the history of leaves is in fact all about Agent Orange and the Vietnam War? It's about good luck, four-leaf clovers, superstition and nettle eating. It's about Christmas and what to do with festive foliage. And it's also about leaf peeping in modern-day New England. Who knew? Or who knew that the history of dolls, yes, dolls have a history, is in fact all about 17th and 18th century fashions. It's about the history of Barbie, 20th century consumerism and patriarchy, Lord and Lady Clapham, and the Victoria and Albert Museum's Victorian automatons. Who knew? Who knew indeed?
Very good. You're probably wondering who is doing all the who knewing. Let me just say of my fellow presenter that if history was tattoo ink and the present day a blank canvas of human skin, this man would be the tattoo artist extraordinaire of the present, colouring in, sketching, writing, doodling on the present day in pictograms of the past. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. And I've already name-dropped you several times today. But were you not paying attention and were wondering still who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot these episodes? Well, let's just say that if he were a skin-related historian, he'd only be, well, not really only be, but sort of be like Dr. John Stockton Hoff US surgeon and unusual bibliophile. Actually, Sam has nothing at all in common with this person. However, what he is common, what is common for him, is that he is so obsessed with his art of history. And I will explain exactly why later on. Because this man was a US surgeon and a rather unusual bibliophile and used skin to cover his important rare books. I'm not saying that you're like this in any way, Sam, but you've guessed it. It's the famous historical adventurer in a rambling kind of way, Dr. Sam Willis.
Yes, I'm sitting here on a desk with a lampshade made of human skin next to my computer.
Next to some tasty Chianti and fava beans, I imagine.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
We're doing skin.
Whose idea was skin? I think it was, I mentioned it, and then you said, let's do it.
Oh, yeah. We've certainly done tattoos before, and we've done scars, so it's
yes.
A natural, it's a natural sort of development of that. Scars we love, don't we? Because it allows the human body to be read like a historical document. You can look at your scars and you can say, oh, I got that scar in 1988 running around a house in Cornwall, and it takes you back. It's a little bridge to a different period in the past. So scars are particularly interesting, and that's just one aspect of skin. I suppose the tattoos I mentioned earlier, tattoos obviously very important, but we're thinking about it maybe in those terms, but also more broadly today. I joked about my lampshade, James, but weirdly, it was one of the first things I was thinking about. I was doing some work on the Second World War and concentration camps in particular, and I came across the story of the lampshade made out of human skin, which was apparently seen in Buchenwald, the very notorious Nazi camp there. Really interesting, because it basically become a kind of a trope of Nazi horrors, but there is a great deal of uncertainty about whether this thing actually existed or not. I was just quite interested in that, because so many of the horrors you come across with the Nazi camps are all true, but this one perhaps it isn't. There are a couple of eyewitness accounts suggesting that there was a lampshade made of tattooed human skin in particular, and it was made for one very specific person in the camp. In subsequent investigations, it seems that this may not necessarily have been true.
I think we're going in similar directions in parts here. But I was spitballing about skin, as you do. And as I said, I'd been wandering around Lisbon, and in particular visited the National Gallery of Ancient Art, and I was struck by the amount of skin on display, nude cherubs everywhere. You know, and it got me thinking about the artistic meaning of skin. And if you think about something about like Titian's Venus of Urbino, and the idea of, you know, of the images to do with seduction, beauty, love, and skin has always been central to ideas about beauty, particularly female skin and of differing hues, and think about makeup and the colour and texture of skin. And this leads us on to thinking about the skin as a blank canvas onto which society could imprint itself, which makes us think about scars and tattoos, as you already said. We've got a lovely little chapter on tattoos in our book on the Romans, but then we can also think about skin colour, which gets us into the world of race and ethnicity, the colour of your skin and markers of difference. But also we can think about different kinds of skin. We've talked about human skin here, but also animal skin. And we've talked about leather. But we can also, in the past, in some of our podcasts, but we can also think about furs. We can think about uses of skin.
James, let me just jump in there. You talking about uses of skin. I've just had a kind of moment of revelation. I'm sitting here in my study, and I was thinking, what are these uses of skin? Certainly, I appreciate vellum and everything. And I thought, I've got a leather-bound book very close to me, so there's a bit of skin. But then I looked around, and with some measure of horror, I've just realised how many things made out of skin there are in my study. So to start with, I've got three swords, and they've all got handles made out of snake skin. Two naval ones and one army one. I've got a beautiful sort of long armchair Which is made out of, it's kind of Victorian, I think it is. It's a really shiny, beautiful, beautiful leather, which I presume is from a cow. I've got, as I said, I've got a piece of vellum. I've got several leather-bound books. And then I thought, on top of that, I've got a suede jacket hanging up behind me. And I just looked at my feet and I'm wearing some sheepskin boots. initially thinking that there was no skin, I've suddenly realised with a genuine kind of feeling of horror that I'm basically surrounded by skin of different types. Horrible, horrible indeed. But that also makes you think about why you might kind of consciously hang on to it. So I think my point here is I've acquired lots of objects, which just, yes, they are made out of skin, but I didn't buy them because they were made out of skin, and I haven't kept them because they are made out of skin necessarily, though maybe the sofa is particularly beautiful. But there are certainly examples of people in the past holding onto things specifically because they are made out of skin. And I was mentioning before that I've just been in Croatia, travelling down the east coast of the Adriatic from Zadar down to Šibenik and then Split further down to Dubrovnik. A fascinating place. I was doing it tracing the remnants of the wonderful Venetian Empire. And while I was there, I came across the most amazing skin story. So what you need to know about the Venetians, they rose up in the aftermath of the collapse of the Roman Empire when power was still in Byzantium, but it was collapsing in Italy. And there were people being threatened all over this area of northern Italy going across to the Istrian Peninsula. A lot of refugees settling in what became the Venice Lagoon, trying to find a bit of safety in the marshes. They made their money trading salt, initially, extremely skilled maritime traders that they were. Then they rose into power. They made a huge deal of money out of the Silk Road by transporting all the goods which came over land from China and India, getting to Constantinople, and then needing some maritime help, some maritime legs to get them across the Mediterranean. The Venetians stepped into this gap, and they became the real middlemen between wealthy Europeans and Germany and France and Britain, Portugal and Spain and so on, and the exotic goods of the East. And a real breakthrough, though, at the beginning of the 13th century, the Fourth Crusade. One of the interesting things that happened in this area was the rise of the Crusades, and none of those crusading armies could really maintain themselves, and in some places not even get to the Holy Land at all without ships. The First Crusade was unusual because they took the overland route, but all subsequent crusades relied heavily on maritime power. And the Venetians stepped into that gap, particularly so with the Fourth Crusade. Anyway, cut a long story short, the Venetians end up manipulating the Crusaders and they make them go and capture Zadar, which is a city, a Christian city. So they make a Christian army go and capture a Christian city in the Adriatic. And then, not only that, after the success of Zadar, they go and they actually capture Constantinople, that not only a Christian city, but the largest Christian city in Christendom. After that, it gave them so much wealth and power and land and territory that they ended up establishing a huge maritime empire right down the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. And that was fine until the mid-15th century when along came the Turks. They capture Constantinople, and with that they get hold of loads and loads of sailors who can build ships, and they contest the sea power of the Mediterranean with the Venetians. Anyway, that's your background. So what we've got here is a huge conflict of the two biggest powers in the period of that part of the Mediterranean in the 15th century. And the Ottomans just grow and grow, and their aggression gets stronger and stronger. And what happens is they decide to besiege and attack the Venetian island of Cyprus. You've been to Cyprus, James?
I have been to Cyprus.
What a place.
Delightful.
Absolutely delightful. Very green, surprisingly green, and that's one of the reasons the Venetians liked it, because if you're a Venetian, you need two things. Well, you need wood for two things. You need wood for ships to protect your trade and protect your empire, and you also need wood to create the foundations for all of those wonderful houses in Venice built in the Swan. They're all built on wooden pillars. So the Ottomans fall on Cyprus, and they attack, and finally they breach the fortifications. The Venetians do very well in their defence, and one of the leaders of the main guy in leading the defence is a guy called Antonio Bragadin. So the Ottoman commander agrees that once the city surrenders, the city of Famagusta, the largest city in Cyprus, he says that basically all Westerners in the city are allowed to exit under their own flag. They get safe passage. But just before this happens, the Ottoman general accuses Bragadin of murdering Turkish prisoners and hiding munitions. And he's so furious that so many Ottomans have died that he takes out a knife. He cuts off Bragadin's ear. Personally, and then he orders his guards to cut off his other ear and also his nose. He's then put in prison. His wounds get infected, and then the humiliation really gets piled on him. He's dragged around the walls with sacks of earth and stone on his back. He's then tied to a chair. He's hoisted to the yardarm of the Turkish flagship, where all the sailors stand around pointing at him and taunting him. And eventually he's taken to the main square of Famagusta, where he is tied to a column and he is skinned. They flay him alive. Once they've done that, he dies halfway through that. They chop his body up into four. But they have his skin. And what they do is they stuff it with straw and they make a kind of hideous dummy out of it. And they put his military insignia back on to his body. And he's sort of shown riding around an ox around the streets of Famagusta. Later, his dummy is shown on the coast of the Levant. And it actually goes all the way back to Constantinople. Then, a little later, this so enrages the Venetians that this is just before a battle called the Battle of Lepanto, where a Christian League, of which the Venetians were one part, absolutely annihilate the Ottoman fleet. And there is a huge fight back against the growth of Ottoman power. And one part of that is a little after the battle is that Bragadin's skin is taken back from Constantinople and it's brought to Venice. And you can still see it today. It is preserved in the Church of St. John and Paul, inside an urn. So there you are, James, a bit of fighting over someone's skin. It's skin as a relic, it's skin as a trophy of war. It's skin being used for ritual humiliation and punishment. There are a great many themes here. But it was just one particular aspect of someone acquiring skin on purpose and deliberately keeping it because of its symbolic and political value.
It's very a very good story for Halloween as well, Sam.
I think it is.
Yeah. Taking this skinning of humans in a different direction, I want to talk about books bound in human skin, and I have been reading a fascinating book recently by a librarian from Philadelphia, a woman called Megan Rosenblum. And this one is specially for Halloween. And the book is called Dark Archives, A Librarian's Investigation into the Science and History of Books Bound in Human Skin. And would you believe it, Sam Willis, that this actually has a technical term? Have you ever heard of something called anthropodermic bibliopagy, which basically is the binding of books in human skin? So the book is absolutely fascinating, and one of the big examples that is at the core of it relates to a medical man called Dr. John Stockton Huff. And this was the person that I likened you to very clumsily at the beginning. And what it recounts an example in January 1869, where he is asked to examine the emaciated corpse of a woman called Mary Lynch. And Mary Lynch is a 28-year-old Irish widow who's admitted to the Philadelphia General Hospital. She's pretty ill, this at this period, and the hospital has a really interesting history in itself. It's a hospital, it's got an orphanage, a poorhouse, an insane asylum, and there's a really interesting tale in that several summers before she was admitted, the female lunatic asylum, the walls collapse, killing 18 women and injuring 20 more. So this is the sort of really creepy pre-story to this. So Mary Lynch is in the hospital. Her family meet her there. They go in and visit her to sort of look after her. They bring her food to eat. They bring her sandwiches with ham and bologna in them, the sort of type of meat. And what they actually don't realise is that these are infested with white specks, which is roundworm infection. And the woman, who is pretty ill herself, then contracts a terrible, sort of disease from these, and it emaciates her already very sort of, you know, weakened state, and she withers away over a 6 month period to about 60 pounds. She's absolutely skeletal and dies shortly afterwards. And John Stockton Hoff recounts this in an article in the American Journal of Medical Science, where he describes operating upon her, and he describes the cutting her open, and he carves open the cavity in her chest to inspect her lungs, which were racked with tuberculosis. And he notices a really odd cyst in her pectoral muscles, and under the microscope it's full of thousands, millions of tiny worms. Writing in this article, he says that counting the number in one grain of muscle, the whole number of cysts were estimated to be about 8 million. So this is in itself is a really fascinating history. You know, this is about dissection, this is about autopsy, this is about tuberculosis. But actually, what is even more remarkable is what he did afterwards. Because after the autopsy, he takes a slice of skin and from her thighs and puts it in a chamber pot. And then what happens is, decades later, this very skin that he's carved off her legs, he uses to bind three of his books, his favourite medical books, which are on topics of women's health and reproduction. And these are very sort of rare and expensive books. And the backstory for this is that he is actually a bibliophile. So he's somebody who is obsessed with books. He comes from a very wealthy family, and one of the things that marked out these late 19th century medical men was their interest in books. This was one of the ways in which they carved out an identity for themselves. And we know quite a bit about him because he spent a lot of time collecting books. He collects all sorts of medical books. He's asked to join book collector societies, such as the Grolier Club in New York, which was established in 1884. And when he dies, it's estimated that he owned around 8,000 books, and many of them are pretty rare. Some of them are 16th and 17th century anatomical texts. Some of them have flaps in them about sort of dissecting a cadaver and all of those kinds of things. He then dies at the age of 56 in a freak accident. He's thrown from a carriage and dies from the fall. The horse sort of vaults, runs away, and he's chucked out of the carriage. And what happens then is his collection goes to the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and in particular to the College of Physicians, which was where he went as a student himself. Now, this is an absolutely fascinating example here. But it's actually not the only example. And what Megan Rosenblum's brilliant book does is it unpacks all sorts of unusual examples of these books, human skin books, that are all over the archives. And I suppose that what they pose is a really delicate problem for curators in libraries. What is it? How do you deal with these kinds of volumes that basically have human skin in them? You know, there's a lot of talk and debate at the moment about repatriating all sorts of objects to the countries of their origin. And I think that also, there's also a moral sort of problem about what institutions do with these skin books, skin-covered books. But so the book goes through a sort of a whole range of sort of different examples from the Bibliothèque Nationale de France in Paris to a tannery in New York, but also to the Surgeons' Hall Museum in Edinburgh. And there is a really interesting little notebook here that is alleged to have been bound in the skin of the William Burke, who was a 19th century body snatcher who operated in Scotland. And, you know, when he was accused of this crime, he was executed and then publicly dissected by Professor Alexandra Munro Tertius at the University of Edinburgh. And this book is now available for people to go and see in the Surgeons' Hall Museum in Edinburgh, and which also has his corpse. So there we are, Sam, a really sort of intriguing example of the use of skin to bind books. And I thought this was something that was very apt for Halloween. And if you want to read more about this, Dark Archives is the title of this book, and it's well worth a read. So there we are, Sam. What did you think of that?
Unbelievable. Gross. And I think very fitting for the podcast on the history of skin. I think everyone's going to feel a little bit queasy after all of that. It did make me think of the queasy aspects of skin. I immediately thought about leprosy when I was researching this, and was wondering how you kind of go about doing it. And unsurprisingly, this has a really fascinating history because it poses some really interesting research problems. So yes, leprosy is one of the oldest diseases known to man, and because of that, the beginnings of leprosy are very much lost to time. But here's the interesting thing. So we know it existed, but we're not entirely sure when, where, or how it was diagnosed. Because the specific chronic disease, which actually is leprosy as we understand it in terms of modern science, modern medicine, wasn't identified until the mid-19th century. Clinical differentiation happened in 1847, and etiological definition in 1874. So although it must have existed long before that, it's very difficult being absolutely certain that what people are talking about is leprosy as we know it. And it's likely that a lot of the other skin ailments which can be confused for leprosy were actually identified as leprosy at the time. So all sorts of skin diseases, vitiligo, psoriasis, lupus, syphilis, and Norwegian scabies, I can tell you, James, as well as bubonic plague, smallpox, whatever it might be, all sorts of skin diseases where the skin is pretty unpleasant one way or another, cause people to identify it as leprosy. So surprisingly difficult to actually identify in the past, and I quite enjoyed that as a historical challenge. So how do you do it? How do you actually get to grips with studying leprosy? Well, one of the ways of doing it is seeing how it appears in law. And there are some, but really not very many, situations in which, legal situations in which leprosy appears in statutory law. There's an example here, which is the writ of de lepreso, the writ de lepreso amovendo. The writ de lepreso amovendo, where a man is a lazar or a leper and is dwelling in any town, and he will come into the church or amongst his neighbours where they are assembled to talk with them to their annoyance and disturbance, then he or they may sue forth that writ for to remove him from their company. But it seemeth if a man be a leper or a lazar and will keep himself within this house and will not converse with his neighbours, that then he shall not be moved out of this house. Bit of a tumbling of words there. Comes from the reign of Henry I, so around 1100. And this is a very important period in the history of leprosy because it was so rife and because at this stage we are certain that it actually was leprosy as we understand it. Later on it becomes less prevalent, though still a problem. This is from the reign of Edward III in 1346. What we've got here is a proclamation to the mayors and sheriffs of London expelling lepers from the city. All persons who have blemish of leprosy shall within 15 days from the date of these presents quit the city and suburbs aforesaid. No persons shall permit such leprous persons to dwell in their houses on pain of forfeiture of house and property. Another way of looking into it is looking at the rules and the regulations linked with leper houses. As an example here from St Julian Hospital in St Albans, where I was born. Those who were infected were to humble themselves below all other men, that they should wear a habit suitable to their infirmity, that those admitted be single persons, or if married, to part by consent and vow chastity, and if afterwards found incontinent to be expelled, to go to church regularly and continue in brotherly love, none to go beyond the bounds prescribed, none to go into the bakehouse or brewhouse, none to touch anything, because persons under such a distemper are not to handle what is for the common use of men. I love that description, James. It made me think about everyone's paranoia of dirty hands around COVID now. Another of those fascinating bridges between present and past. So I'd like to look into that if I was able to do some research into the history of leprosy. But I quite like as well this idea of there being leper houses in London. And I wonder if you could do some kind of geography of sickness in a period and seeing how that changed. So we know these houses may no longer survive, but there's St Giles in Holborn, founded in 1101 by Matilda. So she's the wife of Henry I. We've got St James's in the Fields beyond Westminster for 14 female lepers, one in Hackney, one in Southwark in Kent Street, commonly known as The Lock, one in Mile End, Knightsbridge, Hammersmith. So very interesting. Some of these in the city, some of them outside the walls of the city of London. And some of these fell into ruins, others converted to other uses to serve other diseases sometimes, but other not necessarily all with a long medical history of use. So, James, yeah, I thought that was fascinating. And being able to recreate the geography of the sickness and I think the link between sickness and buildings is interesting. I read something once on the architecture of hospitals in the First World War and how the way that the wards were all built and constructed and laid out changes hugely with changing understandings of medicine. So you can really trace the history of something like leprosy. You'd be able to trace it through the way that the buildings were built, designed and used. Fascinating stuff.
Oh, brilliant.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sam, so we've done people being skinned alive, we've done human skin binding books, we've done leprosy, and now I want to take us in a completely different direction altogether, and I want to talk about sumptuary laws, furs, and skinning cats. Well, and one of the brilliant websites that I've been checking out is for the project Renaissance Skin, which is a fantastic project, Sam. It's a 5-year project funded by the Wellcome Trust Senior Investigator Award. It's based at King's College London. It's led by Professor Evelyn Welsh. And basically what it does is it looks at the wide range of ways in which skin, both animal and human, was conceptualised and used in Europe between 1450 and 1700. This is direct from their website, renaissanceskin.ac.uk. And they have a series of themes. They look at defining skin. They look at protecting skin. They look at all the way in which skin protects. They look at breaking skin. They also look at misbehaving, so the idea of skin and sexual misbehaviour. They look at living, so everyday life and skin. And then they look at consuming skin. And some of what follows comes from their brilliant blog, which you should all check out. That's renaissanceskin.ac.uk for a fantastic 5-year project all on the history of skin, Sam. Now, Sam, picking up on this example of looking at furs and looking at cat skins and looking at sumptuary records, what I want to pick up upon is that conversation that I had with the leather expert Mike Redwood, a brilliant man who knows more about leather than anyone else. And in a conversation I was having with him, he just sort of carelessly, sort of as an aside, was talking about the way in which animal hides would not have been wasted throughout the 16th and 17th century. And I think one of the things that I want to talk about in relation to that is the popularity of cat skins. You know, cats weren't just, you know, pets during the 16th and 17th century throughout medieval and early modern Europe. They weren't just valued for their ability to keep the house clear of pesky rats and mice, but they were also used for their skin. So people actually trapped them, skinned them, and sold them for their fur. And among the most common species of cats were the domestic cat and, of course, the European wild cat. And actually, there's a real difference in the kind of fur that you would get from these animals. The wild cat has a much more luxuriant and thicker coat and tends to be of a uniform shade, unlike the domestic cat, which basically could be all sorts of varieties. And what this meant was that you had all sorts of different colour furs together, and it was much more difficult to sew the pieces of fur together, to stitch them into one sort of piece, unlike the wild cat, which was much more uniform. But this was a really sort of, you know, very, very common sort of form of fur during this period. Now, the other thing that I want to talk about is connecting this sort of cat fur to furs that are suitable for earls. And in the late 1500s, so the end of Queen Elizabeth I's reign in England, there were a series of sumptuary laws that related to dress code. So in other words, these were laws that laid out precisely what people could wear across the social spectrum according to their class and according to their rank. In other words, the more elevated you were in social status, the more extravagant clothing you could wear. And what is noticeable from these sumptuary laws is that often it was the aristocracy, the social elite, that were allowed to wear furs and sables, things of that matter. And this is a wonderful document. You can go to the British Library website and you can actually see a printed example of this, the brief content of certain acts of Parliament against the inordinate use of apparel. And it lays out precisely the kinds of things that people could wear. And I'll just read you some of this here. None shall wear in his apparel any silk of the colour of purple, cloth of gold tissue, but only the king, queen, king's mother, children, brethren, sisters, so in other words, royalty, and except dukes and marquesses to be wear doublets and sleeveless coats, cloth of gold, and purple in mantles of the garter, and cloth of gold, silk, and then it goes down about woollen cloth, velvet, furs, can be worn by dukes, marquesses, earls. So you get this sense that actually quite valuable and exquisite, luxurious furs were being worn by the nobility. And that leads us to think about the kinds of furs that a nobleman in the Elizabethan period might have had in his wardrobe. And we have a superb and detailed inventory for William Herbert, the first Earl of Pembroke, who lived between 1506 to 7. We don't know exactly his birth date. Lived between 1506 to 7, all the way through dying in 1570. So dying in his early 60s. And this inventory was drawn up in 1561, listing all of his movable goods. And there are all sorts of things there. The manuscript is held at the National Art Library in the Victoria and Albert Museum. He's got all sorts of wonderful things, including a unicorn's bone set in gold with one turquoise, two rubies and three diamonds. And along with this sort of list of movable goods, there is also a list of his extensive opulent wardrobe, titled An Inventory of All Such Apparel, Furs and Jewels as Be in the Charge of Thomas Gregory, the 17th of August, Anno Domini, 1561. And there are all kinds of things here. And what's interesting is that most of the outer garments that he would have worn would have been lined with imported and highly expensive furs. And sometimes several furs would have been used to line things. So it might be squirrel fur edged with sable fur, for example. And what's interesting is that the ubiquity of the fur meant that it was mentioned when there was no fur on an item. And I just want to sort of give you a sense of the opulence of this. So there are various sort of types of fur that he would have had. Sable fur, which is a species of marten, like a sort of, you know, stoat kind of thing, which is soft dark brown or black fur, and is a beautiful and fair fur. So just to sort of give you some examples of the items here, his sable garments included a long gown of black damask and a guard of velvet and a welt of velvet on either side of the guard, laid upon with a pommel lace of silk, pearled on the one side, set with eight great buttons of gold and with pearls in every button, black, green and blue enamelled, furred with sables. And another one here, a gown of black satin faced with sable tails and furred behind with kid, guarded with velvet and welted with the same o'erthwart, and cut set with 36 pair aglets white enamelled. So you get a real sense of quite how opulent these were. But alongside the sable, there is also lynx. Lynx is a very, very pricey fur in the 16th century, and is a thick spotted fur. You can imagine a sort of lynx as a wild cat. And he has several lynx coats, and these would be reddish in summer, so a short reddish summer coat and thick grey brownish coat. These are sort of typical of the lynx coats. One of them here is a gown of russet satin with two plain guards of velvet, fringed on every side, and a lace of black silk upon the guard, set with 36 eight pair of great aglets full of pearls, and furred throughout with lucernes. And lucernes is the lynx, because that's the sort of 16th century reference for lucernes. He also had squirrel coat, and squirrel would be much more commonly found, red squirrels in particular during this period, and often these squirrel furs would be edged with other kinds of furs. And just to give you a sort of sense of some of the things that he had here, a cassock of black satin with 6 welts of the same, and between way 2 welts, a fringe of black silk and gold with lope buttons of black silk and gold, furred with calabra and edged with sables. And then also rabbit would be used, polecat would be used, genet is another type of cat that were imported from Spain and North Africa, and also a fox fur would be used. And I'll give you a reading here from one of the items of clothing here. A gown of russet silk sackcloth with 1 broad guard and 2 little guards of black velvet, furred with fox. That sounds beautiful, Sam, doesn't it? There's also ermine. Ermine would have been used for his coronation and parliamentary robes, but also wolf and grey wolf in particular, imported into England from Spain. Lambskin was another example, and you're wearing lambskin boots today, Sam, which sound very fine. So there we are, Sam. Skinning a cat, sumptuary laws, and aristocratic fur wearers. Now, Sam, just before we go, and just before we sign off, I have one little Halloweeny anecdote to end on, which is connected to witchcraft and skin. And have you ever heard of something called an amniotic membrane? Now, this is the skin that would have contained the child in the womb, or the sort of umbilical cord. And this, throughout the 17th century, was associated with witchcraft and had various sort of magical properties. And there is an example from the Inquisition in Bologna in Italy from 1699, where there's a deposition of a man called Ludovico Zanardi, and he recounts in this something relating to a local courtesan, so in other words, a local prostitute. And the report has it that about a month ago, I do not remember which day exactly, a certain Domenica, the daughter of Giovanni Battista Mazzoni, who is a poor beggar in the city, both came to my house. Since I was talking about the troubles I have in getting my own daughters married, said Domenica, began to say that she knew very well how a woman could get a man to love her. She told me that she had stolen a piece of caul or cuticle. In other words, this is the amniotic membrane which envelops baby boys or girls when they are born, and that she obtained this cuticle from a certain Venetian woman who was her mistress, of whom I do not know the name. And this woman, this Venetian woman, is then who's accused of being a whore.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Was supposed to have used this call in order to make people fall in love with her. So there we are. She's accused of witchcraft. She eventually gets off. But it shows you the magical properties that could be associated with particular pieces of skin on the body. Now, I hope that's a sort of fitting way to end, and I hope everyone has a brilliant Halloween.
Well, there we go. A wonderful history of skin. James, I think this has been a classic episode. I shall look forward to listening back on one of my many walks around town. Guys, I hope you enjoyed that. Do please follow me on social media. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in maritime and naval history, do please check out my other podcast, the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And you can follow me on social media on Twitter at James Daybell. You can follow the podcast at Unexpected Pod. We are also on Instagram and Facebook. And if you want to become a patron of Histories of the Unexpected, go over to Patreon, to our Histories of the Unexpected Patreon account. And if you want to support what we're doing, that would be absolutely superb. We also have an all-singing, all-dancing website, historiesoftheunexpected.com, where you can find out everything that we've been up to and our back catalogue of episodes.
And also our books. Christmas is fast approaching and they do make the best Christmas presents in the whole world. We'll even sign them for you. Thank you all so much for listening, guys. And we're back. I think we're going to do Tiles and the Yawn next. Ooh, going to be fun.
Excellent. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.